nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
So, who am I? I'm Ilias Bilionis. I'm an assistant professor at the School of Mechanical Engineering here at Purdue. This is my fourth year at Purdue. I used to be at Argo National Laboratory at the Mathematics and Computer Science Division. And I did my PhD at Cornell University in Applied Mathematics. And before that, I was in Greece, where I finished my bachelor in applied mathematics as well. And I am from Greece, by the way. You should go and, you know, go for vacation during summer, leave us some money. We need you. So my topic today is uncertainty quantification. And you will see, hopefully, what you are going to see is that it is pretty much needed in every single discipline, and pretty much everybody is doing it, but most of us do a crappy job when we're trying to quantify uncertainties. So this talk typically is a little bit more mathematical than what you're going to see today. I have stripped away all the math. I'm only going to talk about concepts and move my hands to explain stuff, okay? So it's going to be around 20 minutes, maybe a little bit less. I mean, I'm going to be looking at you whenever I see that you have finished eating. I'm going to stop and have you play with your computer. So there's a handout that you must all have. This handout basically goes through the concepts I'm going to go through in the lecture and asks a couple of questions that, you know, you can use to see what you've learned, and then there's an example of a physical system from a chemical model, a model of catalysis with uncertainty, and we're going to try to propagate uncertainties through an actual physical model. Now, you're going to have to do this on your NanoHub account using the Jupyter notebook tool. Hopefully you'll know how to do that. If you don't know how to do that, Salar is here to help you starting. Now, you must all have received an email with some files that I ask you to upload on that tool. Otherwise, nothing, you can do absolutely nothing. And, well, feel free to start it. You can go as fast or as slow as you want and get as much done as you want, all right? Whoever finishes it all gets nothing, basically. But, you know, you'll get the satisfaction of completing something. Anyway, so let's get started. What is uncertainty quantification, or why is it needed? Now, according to Wikipedia, it is the science of quantitative characterization and reduction of uncertainties in applications. Right, so all applications have uncertain things. There are parameters in the model that we don't really know exactly what they are. Maybe we cannot measure them precisely. Maybe we are unsure about the form of the model. Maybe there may be a human error. All right, so all sorts of uncertainties. And what I'm personally trying to do is develop methods that allow you to understand, describe, and control these uncertainties. Right? But we're not going to get into what I do. We're just going to get into why this thing is needed. So I'll give you a simple example from an application of structural reliability. So imagine that you have a building with a lot of stories, and you have it in a region where earthquakes occur. I don't know, California, Japan, you name it. And you don't really know what kind of earthquake is going to hit that building. So there's always a possibility that an earthquake of a given magnitude can hit the building, and an earthquake of a given magnitude can have many different forms. You know, the ground may be shaking this way, or maybe shaking that way, or maybe that way, I don't know. All right? But it's not something that is very specific, so that thing is kind of uncertain. And what we'd like to do is quantify the uncertainty in the hazard event, let's say the earthquake event, and propagate that uncertainty. I don't know why this thing is moving. Okay. So we want to propagate that uncertainty through a model of the building. So that will be, for those of you that are civil engineers, do we have any civil engineers here? No. Okay. So nobody is a civil engineer, but mechanical engineers should understand that this is basically kind of like a truss model of a building, but we look at the dynamics of that model, and we see how it vibrates when you hit it with an external forcing, and you can use these the response of the simulation to compute the probability that the building will fail if a earthquake of a given magnitude hits it. All right. And if you have that probability, then you can estimate the average cost, the probability of incurring a certain cost, right? The expected cost, the variance of that cost, which you would call risk. And you have a city, you can do that for every single building, right? And if you have an insurance company, that's what you should be doing to compute your premiums. All right, so that's useful stuff right there. All right, another example from the operation of an oil reservoir. So imagine that an oil reservoir is basically a region in the soil that is kind of like a sponge. There's no really a cavity, but it has like sponge-like qualities. There are little, very small holes, and inside these small holes, there is oil. All right. So what you do when you want to extract oil, initially you just drill one hole, and because the oil is under pressure inside, it comes out naturally until the pressure inside the well is the same as the pressure outside the well, and then it stops coming out. Then you need to drill another hole, pump water through that hole to push the oil out of the oil out of the of the other hole. And in this way, you can get about 50% of the oil out of the reservoir. And then after you're done with that, you start pumping up other types of chemicals. It's not very good for the ground, but it's very good for your pocket. Now, where's the uncertainty there? The uncertainty basically is that you don't really know how the ground looks like. You don't really know where the oil is. We don't really know the formations of the soil, right? And the only way to figure out what the soil looks like is to drill, take a part of the soil out and look at it. That's one way to figure that out. But you can't, of course, do that everywhere because it costs money to drill and look at it. And also if you drill somewhere that there's oil, the oil is going to come out. Okay. That's also a problem. What else can you do? The other thing that you can do is you can hit the ground. You can hit the ground like that and measure the response at certain sensors that you have distributed along the space and try to, from that response, to figure out what the soil looks like. Right? So you can measure the time it takes for a signal to propagate through the soil, and with that you can try to invert, using the acoustic equation, the properties of the soil. But in any case, you can never be absolutely sure about what the soil looks like. Therefore, you cannot be absolutely sure about the amount of oil you're going to produce up to a given time. So if you are ExxonMobil, for example, you would like to create an uncertainty model for the ground. And when you want to calculate, let's say, the amount of money you're going to get out of an investment, you would like to use this uncertainty to quantify your risk. So there you can have two kinds of uncertainties when it comes to oil production, right? It's the price of the oil, which you don't really know what it is, right? And also the uncertainty of the ground, because you don't really know how the ground looks like. All right. Another example, predicting extreme weather, like a hurricane and stuff like that. So we pretty much know how to describe, I mean, not everything is settled, but we know a lot about how to describe the motion of gases in the atmosphere. So we know that we need to use thermodynamics, fluid mechanics, and so on and so forth. We can write down the equations that describe the pressure and the temperature and the velocity of the various gases that are in the atmosphere. These are partial differential equations. All right. Of course, we're not absolutely sure about every single parameter of these partial differential equations because we have not measured everything. But nevertheless, it's a partial differential equation, and let's assume that you actually know them exactly. Now, a partial differential equation in order to start solving it and make predictions about what's going to happen, you need to know the state of all the variables, the temperature, the pressure, the velocities of the air, everywhere at time zero. So right now, tell me what is the pressure field across all the Earth. What is the temperature field across all the Earth? Of course, this is something ridiculous. You can't know that, right? So what can you know? You have a few thousand or tens of thousands of weather stations that measure these variables distributed across, mostly United States, all the other, Africa. I don't think you have that many. And you also have some of the oceans, right? And you have satellite data as well. And you use this data to estimate the initial conditions of these partial differential equation system. Right? But of course, you're not absolutely sure about what they are. So you're like, maybe it's that, maybe it's that. I don't really know. Okay? Well, if you don't really know, you must quantify this uncertainty, the initial conditions, and propagate it through the solver that the numerical solver that tells you what the solution of the partial differential equations is. And that's why when you have a hurricane, you don't really know exactly where it's going to go. If you knew exactly what the temperature, the pressure, the velocity of the air is everywhere on Earth right now, or at least everywhere around the important region, then you would tell exactly where it goes. But the slightest uncertainty in this initial condition, because the system of equation has chaotic behavior, will limit your ability to predict where exactly it's going to go. So what you typically see is this banana that predicts the path of the hurricane, and the way this banana is generated is as follows. You sample one possible set of conditions for your partial differential equations, you put it into that solver that takes about an hour, let's say, to run one simulation on a high-performance computer, maybe a little bit less. Then you wait for an hour, you get the result, and that's going to give you one path for the hurricane. One path may be doing this, okay? Then you do it again. You sample initial conditions, you put it in your solver, you get another path, and you repeat that a few hundred times or a few thousand times, and using this ensemble of simulations, you can get an estimate, a predictive error bar, let's say, an estimate of where the earthquake can go with uncertainty. All right, and that uncertainty indicates your uncertainty about the initial conditions. Now, as you add more and more weather stations to the point where you have a weather station at every square kilometer, then you may be able to reduce that uncertainty a lot. All right, so don't blame the meteorologist for not being able to predict exactly where it goes, because it's kind of impossible, okay? All right. So what kind of uncertainties are there, and how do we model these uncertainties? This is another topic that I want to touch on. By the way, if you have any questions whatsoever, so raise your hand, stop me, and ask that question, okay? So we say that we have two kinds of uncertainties. The first kind of, I'm going to introduce just two concepts. First kind of uncertainty is aleatory uncertainty. Okay, just this is just the name that we use for it. Aleatory uncertainty has to do with uncertainty that cannot be reduced. There's nothing you can do about it. It's true randomness. Okay? It just is what it is. True randomness. If that thing even exists, okay? If it exists, we're going to call it aleatory uncertainty. And I want you to remember the term aleatory uncertainty. And wherever you are working in your project, you should stop and say, I'm uncertain about this thing. Is it true randomness? Or maybe if I pay the price, I can learn more about it and reduce my uncertainty. So if you can pay a price and reduce your uncertainty, then you say that you have epistemic uncertainties or reducible uncertainties. So I'll give you examples of these two types of uncertainties, but I want you to remember aleatory equals irreducible uncertainty, true randomness, epistemic uncertainty is a reducible uncertainty. If I have the funds, I can reduce it. Maybe I, you know, maybe I don't have the funds, so it just has to stay there. But if you have the funds, you can reduce it. So let's talk about the types of uncertainty that we have. Let's see a specific example. So here you have an example of a bevel gear, of a system of two bevel gears. So this is used to transmit motion from one shaft to another shaft, change angle of rotation, basically. And it's a very a place where you can find this system is basically at helicopters, right at the rotor. Okay, so it's a crucial part of the helicopter design. And you really need to make this, especially for helicopter applications, because they take a lot of load, you need to make them very, very strong. Now, if you zoom in and you look at the, you just take a small region right here and zoom in and look at the material that makes this, with which you make the gear, you're gonna see a microstructure. So typically they're made out of steel. So here what you see is a scanning electron image of the steel. Okay? So no matter what you do, you can already know exactly how the microstructure looks at the entire gear. Okay? Because the only way you can do that is to cut the gear in tiny small pieces. Okay? Destroy the gear. Put them in an electron microscope and look at it. That's the only way you can know. So you don't want to do that because that's ridiculous. Okay? So even though the uncertainty you have about the gear is epistemic uncertainty, it's not true randomness. Because if you take a gear, it has a very specific microstructure at a given moment, right? It's a very specific, definite matter. It's not changing. It's not drawing, it's not throwing dice, even throwing dice. It's probably not that random, as random as you think, but it's very, very specific. So it's kind of epistemic uncertainty. But to figure out what it is, you have to destroy the gear. Okay? So it's, alright, yeah, we can pay the price to see what it really is. So it is epistemic uncertainty, reducible uncertainty, but maybe we don't want to pay that price. Give you another example, the soil porosity that we're talking about, in the oil reservoir example. Again, the soil is whatever it is something very specific. You just don't know what it is. Okay? So you have epistemic uncertainty again. So the uncertainty you have about how the ground looks like, it's an epistemic uncertainty. You can drill, take a piece out and look at it, and eliminate your uncertainty. Another example of epistemic uncertainty. So you may be interested in simulating biomolecules, for example, right? And when you simulate biomolecules, you are basically taking samples from this distribution over there called the Boltzmann distribution, which has certain parameters. One of the important inputs to that distribution is the potential energy function. This is the energy of the molecule, okay? So you absolutely need that. Now, the problem is that you don't really know what that is. You can guess what it is, okay? There is theory that tells you that, you know what, if you are willing to solve the Schrödinger equation with all the electrons in there, then maybe that's the right potential energy function. But guess what? You cannot do that. So now you have uncertainty about the form of your model. You have uncertainty about the energy function, which is basically kind of like a physical law that you have to assume. You can reduce it in principle. So you know the mathematical equation that is going to give you V, but you just cannot solve it with all the computing power in the world. Right? So is this, what kind of uncertainty is this? Is it epistemic? Is it, it is in principle reducible, but it's not reducible with the current technology. What was that?
Last?
Yeah, the last option. Is it epistemic or aleatory? Yeah, who knows? Maybe in the future, it will be reducible. The other point I want to make here is that maybe it doesn't really matter if the uncertainty is aleatory or epistemic, because given your current resources, you know, you can think of something as either aleatory or epistemic, but let me not confuse you anymore. I'll show you something that is the closest thing not the closest, the second closest thing I could find to something that is truly random. And this is the thermal radiation that is left over from the Big Bang. So you can see it. I mean, you cannot see it in modern TVs, but if you have one of these old TVs, you can turn it on and look at it. Or if you have a radio, you can listen to it. Okay? So that's the closest thing that I can think of to true randomness. There's nothing really you can do about it. It just is what it is. But of course, someone may tell you, you know, if you know exactly the equations of the universe and you know exactly how it started, maybe you can simulate it and then say exactly what this image is going to look like. But that's ridiculous, obviously. So who knows? Perhaps in principle it is epistemic, but in reality it's not. Now, the closest thing that I could find to something truly random has to do with the motion of an electron and quantum mechanics. So you have a gun that throws electrons, and you have two slits, all right? And have you heard of this experiment, the two-slit experiment? You throw electrons, and the electron is going to go either through one or the other, or maybe through both. So this is really strange, because it doesn't really go through one or the other, okay? And you can experimentally test that. It kind of goes through both, and there's reason to believe that this is true aleatory uncertainty, true irreducible uncertainty. There's nothing you can do about it. Okay, you can only say where exactly the electron is going to go. All right, and another type of uncertainty that I would like you to think about is turbulence. So turbulence, you know, is basically our inability to predict exactly what to solve exactly the fluid mechanics equation and predict what is going to happen when you have very high speeds. So what do you think about turbulence? Do you think it's aleatory or is it epistemic? Aleatory. I think I kind of agree with you, but let me take a poll. Who thinks it's epistemic? Nobody. Who thinks it's aleatory? Okay, and everybody else doesn't have an opinion. That's good. It's good not to have an opinion in these matters, okay? Because it's debatable. I don't know, okay? Maybe it's aleatory, maybe it's epistemic. And, you know, one can argue that if you want to use computational fluid mechanics to figure out exactly what a fluid does, and you use a super fine discretization of your domain, then you can resolve everything. So there's no turbulence, because you can resolve absolutely everything. But in real life, you cannot really do that. You cannot, you know, have tiny cells in your finite volume scheme. You cannot really do that. You cannot afford to do that for all the computing power of in the world. So it is an irreducible uncertainty. Anyway, and we have this problem over and over again. It's kind of a philosophical question. Is it epistemic or is it irreducible? Now, my message to you is that you should not really care, okay, about what it is. It is uncertainty, and whether it is aleatory or epistemic, it's kind of a philosophical question. If it is epistemic and you can see it and you can see how you can pay to reduce it, you just pay as much as possible to reduce it and forget about it. But any type of uncertainty, either it is epistemic or aleatory, we describe it in exactly the same way, and the way we describe it is using probability theory. Right, so we use probability theory to say things like, so we take a logical proposition A, which is something that we say about a quantity of interest, and when we write P of A given K, we actually say how much do we believe that something A is true. For example, this parameter has this value. The mass of that object is 2 kilograms. How much do we believe that A, the scientific sentence A, is true given our current state of knowledge? Given everything we know about all the theories in the world and all the data we can collect up to this point. This is what we want to be able to say. Of course, I'm not going to go into that. But if you want to know more about probability theory, this guy right here, E.T. James, is the guy behind the maximum entropy principle. Principle that allowed him to state all of statistical mechanics in one paper. his book, Probability Theory, The Logic of Science, is an excellent read. A little bit difficult to get it started. But if you read it for the third time, it goes like a breeze. Okay? So, what we really want to do, and what I'm doing in my research, is saying things like that. What is the probability that I get a specific sample of a microstructure, given all the data that I have so far? So I have a couple of bevel gears that I have cut and looked at, and I'm using this data to create a mathematical model that allows me to sample possible microstructures. Right? That's one of the things that I do, is construct models like that. And it's a little bit more complicated than this thing that you see right here. It has a few more mathematical details at the bottom, but I'm not going to go into any of that. Because you already started sleeping, so it's a good place to stop. And that's what we call the uncertainty quantification problem. It's a density estimation problem. You have a bunch of data, you have data, you have to figure out the process, to describe the process that generates this data. These data. Alright, so I have like two or three more minutes, and I'm going to formalize this a little bit to help you go through your handout. So imagine that we have a physical model or experiment, and that physical model has some parameters that you can control or not. Okay? So let's say you cannot control the parameters, or you cannot control them exactly. And once you specify these parameters in your model, you can compute a quantity of interest. All right? And you can think of this as, I'm going to call the input parameters X, I'm going to call that physical model F, and the quantities of interest Y. So you can think this process as a function. Right? So your physical model is basically a function that takes all the parameters that it requires and it gives you back a number or two numbers or a function. Okay? Right? It gives you a Y back. So what I want you to think about, I'm going to skip this. What we're going to do in the handout is the following thing. We're going to say, well, we're a little bit uncertain about X. How does that uncertainty propagate through the model to Y? So if you are uncertain about the mass of an object, how would that change its natural frequency, right? So if you are uncertain about the stiffness coefficient of a spring, how would that change the maximum amplitude of oscillation? Whatever, okay? So what we're going to do in the handout is this is going to be a chemical reaction model, a catalysis model. It's a differential equation. We're going to be uncertain about some parameters of that differential equation called the reaction coefficients. And we're going to propagate this uncertainty through the reaction model and see how the products that we get out of that reaction are affected by that uncertainty. Now, the technique we're going to use to do that, okay, so just to give you an idea, that's what we're going to do. We're going to assign a probability distribution on X and propagate this uncertainty through the model to characterize our uncertainty about Y. And the technique we're going to use to do this is called Monte Carlo. It was invented at Los Alamos by these three guys, Fornauman, Richard Feynman, and Ulam. I don't remember his other name. Okay, I'm sorry. So these guys invented this technique to do statistical mechanics. Okay, statistical mechanics has a lot of probability, a lot of uncertainty, and you need to estimate expectations of things. So they developed this technique to do just that, to compute expectations. And after the war, their results were published and everybody knew about it. So it goes like that. Very simple, all right? So you sample random inputs many, many times. For each one of the random inputs, you evaluate your model. And then you look at all the evaluations of the model and you do statistics. You say, okay, what is the average? What is the variance? Right? Very, very simple. So here how it goes. How do you propagate its uncertainty through the model? You sample an X, you take it through, you look at Y. You write it down. You do it again. You sample an X, you take it through, you look at Y. You sample an X, you take it through, you look at Y. And you do that as many times as you can afford. And then what you're going to get here is a bunch of Ys, an ensemble of Ys that correspond to your uncertainty about the process. And then you can look at the histogram of Ys, you can compute statistics of Ys, and so on and so forth. All right? Now, let me just tell you that Monte Carlo doesn't really work in real examples because they're just too expensive. Right? So if you have a numerical weather prediction model that takes a day on a supercomputer to do a single simulation, you don't do that. Okay? If you have a multi-scale finite element model that considers the microstructure of a bevel gear, but you go up to the continuum level and then you need to run it until a crack appears, that's ridiculous. You cannot do more than one simulation. Okay? So in real life, it's completely useless until your model is very, very cheap. Okay? But it's a starting point. I mean, that's the first thing that you should try to do because it's the simplest. If you want to know more about why it is fundamentally unsound, you can look at that paper. All right. So, but let's ignore these problems completely and start playing with the handout. You have 30 minutes. Now you can do as much or as little as you want about it, with it. Now I would ask you, please, to, if you don't have a laptop, to find a friend who has a laptop and work with them. Please do not work on your poster. Work on this. Do as much as possible, all right? But try to work on this. Unless you'll get something out of it, that something would be there is a field called uncertainty quantification and you need it even though you don't know it yet, okay? That's the take-home message. So then I also have a job that's very important. So .com. For the handout, I have instructions, 11 steps. Now you need to download the zipped version of the code that we send you via email. You uncompress it anywhere you want. If you know how to use Jupyter on your laptop, go ahead and just use it, right? It's a Jupyter notebook. If you don't, I would ask you to log into NanoHub and launch the Jupyter notebook tool and then start uploading the files. And once you do that, you're going to be able to run it and go through it. Okay?